From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. 100 years ago, the nation was rocked by race riots and massacres of African Americans. Today on the show, we'll learn about the Red Summer of 1919. Then musician and composer Mario Quadracci takes it out of the basement and onto the stage.
The end result wasn't really the goal in the beginning. I've always loved music, went to school for music, and just kind of started to develop this sound and these techniques that enabled me to emulate different instruments and, I guess, create people to play with who weren't there.
And New York Times bestselling author Mary Alice Monroe explains what drives her writing.
What I'm really after is that we all feel connected to this beautiful planet that we share, to the animals on it. Because if we connect to nature, I honestly know that we will have better relationships with those people in our lives we connect with on a daily basis.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. This year marks the centennial anniversary of a dark chapter in American history. During the summer of 1919, race riots and massacres spread to dozens of cities throughout the country in a series of events that would become known as Red Summer. Although hundreds were killed and entire communities were destroyed, the stories of these events aren't featured prominently in our history books. Still, Reggie Jackson believes the legacy of these events can be found in the many civil rights victories that have happened in the century since the Red Summer. Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum here in Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and explains the cultural conditions in the U.S. before that summer.
World War I was ending. Many blacks had served in the war effort in Europe, had been treated pretty well over there, and came back and said, oh, well, we had fought for freedom and democracy, and we're going to demand that here. And people in the South did not particularly appreciate the fact that blacks came back very prideful. And there were a series of lynchings and major race riots around the country that summer. It actually started in April of that year and lasted all the way through November. You know, massive acts of anti-black violence around the country. And it was a very ugly period, and it's known by historians as Red Summer.
Yeah, it's called Red Summer. Of course, you know, you look at that time period in the United States, and lynchings had been going on for a while at that point, but this was really on another level. What was the initial event that kind of spurred the rest of this summer?
Well, you know, I don't think that there were necessarily any specific event. These were kind of things that were going on. There were instances of violent clashes between blacks and whites in major cities around the country. Issues in the South where blacks were still primarily living, where they were demanding equal treatment. They were demanding the right to vote again. So all those different things. But really kind of the first incident was in Georgia, in a small town in Georgia. A man ended up being murdered by a mob of whites because he had the audacity to write an article about a black person who had been lynched. Allegedly, he wrote the article, but no one really knows who wrote the article that was printed in the most prominent black newspaper, the Chicago Defender. So people in his town accused him of writing this article, you know, talking about whites who lynched this black person. And he refused to admit that he wrote the article. He said that he didn't. And they actually chased him down and eventually killed him. And that was in April of 1919. That was the first real kind of incident of what became Red Summer.
And it's something that, of course, spirals into a number of what seem to be called race riots. But the term riot seems a little misleading here in that a lot of these were just massacres. Mm-hmm. Where does the term riot, when does that start to kind of come in?
Well, you know, one of the things about it is we kind of have this perception of race riots in the country as the things that happened in the 1960s in Detroit and Newark and Milwaukee and place that nature, or after the Rodney King affair in 1992. But these were actually completely different. Blacks referred to them as riots in their newspapers because what generally happened in most of these incidents were some incident would spark some incident between blacks and whites in that community, and it would lead eventually to roaming mobs of armed whites, mostly men, but also women and children sometimes, leaving their community and going into black communities and beating people, looting their homes, looting their businesses, killing people, lynching people openly. So, you know, I tell people all the time that these are the race riots that you didn't hear about because the perpetrators are whites.
Well, and that's something that came up almost immediately when I started researching this. You know, I talked to a number of people just casually about, you know, my work, and they had never heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
They'd
mm-hmm.
never heard of the Red Summer of 1919. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of amazing how much it has been buried. Why do you think it's been buried in our collective history?
Well, I think the main reason it's been buried is because it's a very ugly time period in American history. It's one of those parts of our history that we prefer to ignore because it makes us look bad. When you kind of look into the details of how these things played out, you know, Red Summer was kind of, it was kind of the culmination of many years of these types of events. So, you know, you go back to 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was a major race riot there, which was caused by whites who were upset that there were so many black elected officials. They actually had a coup d'etat where they actually removed all the black elected officials and any whites who supported them. And then you had a major race riot in Atlanta in 1906, a major one in Springfield, Ohio, 1908. 1917, East St. Louis, Illinois, there was another major one. So these were things that had been happening for a significant period of time in that particular summer, I think primarily as a result of blacks coming back from the war and having obviously been trained and using firearms and saying we're gonna protect our communities better than we could before because we know how to use these guns. And, you know, there were several black GIs who were actually lynched in their uniforms when they came back from serving in World War I. And so when you kind of look at it, it's not a period of time that America is really proud of. And we have a very high tendency of covering up these parts of American history because they don't fit in with the narrative of America being this place with liberty and justice for all. They fly in the face of that. So we prefer to run away from these things, hide from it, cover it up, not talk about it. But, you know, it's part of, for African Americans in particular, it's part of our lived experience. These are things that we don't forget. We talk about these things all the time. We are intimately familiar with these events. But most people aren't because they didn't learn about it in school because it's not in the textbooks in our school systems.
Well, and you think to yourself, this is really something that crafted the views of people at that time period and a legacy that continues to shape our view of race relations in this country, whether we recognize that or not.
Yeah, absolutely. We tend to not really kind of now understand why race relations are so difficult. And I say primarily the reason is because we don't know American history very well. We have not been taught many of these things that would really help us understand why race relations are what they are today. And it goes back many, many years. And what's fascinating about the summer of 1919, obviously, we're celebrating, I guess, memorializing the 100th anniversary of that summer. We're also memorializing the 400th anniversary of the first Africans to arrive on slave ships in August of this year. So, you know, this is kind of an important year. But one of the things that I want people to kind of understand about Red Summer is the resilience of the black communities who were attacked and lost, you know, people. They did something that had very rarely been done in that way. And that was to fight back. And that fight that they had in them at that particular time was really, in many ways, the beginnings of the modern civil rights movement. Those things led to the NAACP becoming more involved in advocating for, you know, fair treatment of blacks. You began to have court cases challenging Jim Crow segregation. You began to see really a strong push for blacks to change the way that they were being treated, and particularly because they said, you know, we're fighting this war in Europe for freedom and justice there, but we're not receiving it here. We are going to demand it here, and that really began a push over a number of years for significant changes in America.
Well, and that comes up in maybe the most famous of these incidents. in Elaine, Arkansas. So this was something that involved sharecroppers. For people who might not know what sharecropping is, can you explain that a bit?
So sharecropping was a system that developed after slavery ended. You still had these large farms in the South. You had blacks who living in these rural communities who couldn't find work for the most part. Some of them got work as what were known as sharecroppers. So there would be some land that had some crop on it, like cotton or some other crop, and they needed workers. They needed farmers. And so what they would do is white landowners would allow a black family to work the land for them and then supposedly give them a share of the profits from it. That's where the name comes from. But in most cases, the way it worked was that they would be given, you know, a place to live. They'd be, you know, allowed to use kind of the plantation store to buy food and clothing and things of that nature. But that would come out of the profits that they would get at the end. And what ends up happening generally for most sharecroppers at the end of this, and there were whites who were sharecroppers as well, is that by the end of the year, once you know harvest the crop and you do the books, you find out that you're in debt to that person. And so you have to start off the new year in debt, and it's kind of a continuing cycle perpetuated. And this system, sharecropping, lasted all the way through the 1970s. Before it finally kind of went away, primarily because of more mechanized farming and less need for that type of labor. But it was a system that was very corrupt. Blacks who challenged, whites who were cheating them out of their money, were in many cases lynched or run out of town. And it was a system that was the primary means of making ends meet for blacks throughout the South for a long period of time.
Well, that's essentially what happens in Elaine. A number of these sharecroppers get together and they say, this isn't right. This isn't fair. Can you tell us a bit about what happened in Elaine?
Well, you know, any time there were instances of black individuals or groups who challenged the system of sharecropping or any system that minimized their aspirations for doing better, they would always be challenged. And so this group of black sharecroppers got together and said, wait a minute. Every year we're getting shorted money, we're getting cheated, and we don't think it's right, and we need to collectively challenge this. And so they put together a group to challenge the system, and the whites who owned the land did not appreciate it. They were very angry about it, and what ends up happening is one thing leads to another, and there ends up being this large group of white men who are armed who attack this group of sharecroppers for doing what really was the right thing to do to get some fairness out of the system. And it leads to a very bloody couple days in Elaine, Arkansas. And in many respects, many of those blacks who were fighting ended up fleeing Elaine, Arkansas. Of course, they were blamed for the violence themselves, even though they didn't start it. And it was kind of the norm for how most of these riots took place, was the black victims would be blamed in some way, shape, or form for their victimhood.
But unlike a lot of these riots, it does culminate in a case that goes to the Supreme Court. A number of them are, you know, given the death sentence for their participation, but they appeal it and they appeal it, and it creates this landmark case.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the things, like I said earlier, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund started to get involved in these cases in. These men were challenging the system of sharecropping. They were challenging whether or not the system was fair, and then all of a sudden they're accused of violence and murder. And they knew that that wasn't the case. They were certainly not going to just accept that as being their station in life, being sent to prison for murder, and they challenged it. And it was one of those things that was very rarely done for blacks to have the ability to challenge these types of convictions and have it go all the way to U.S. Supreme Court. It was something that was exceptionally rare, and it set a precedent for other cases moving forward that we can do this. And it really, like I said, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund really played a huge role in this. They had been gathering together some of the best black attorneys in the country to make sure that blacks had the type of representation that they needed and that they could have success with. And so that was just one example of type of work that they did. And, you know, some of these same attorneys were involved in other cases around the country. Some of these same attorneys were some of the people who built the case to end Jim Crow segregation over a period of 20-plus years. So this is really one of those things that happened that show blacks that, you know, if we have the right resources available to us, then we can begin to make some gains and fight against some of these unjust systems in the South.
Well, and essentially they found that the men on trial were not judged by a jury of their peers because their peers were not allowed to be in the jury.
Yeah, and, you know, that was pretty typical in the South, is that you had all white juries. And so, you know, jury of your peers with no blacks on it. And there were a variety of reasons that blacks weren't on the juries. Many of them weren't allowed to vote, and so that was a requirement in some places. And in other places, it was simply like it didn't matter. We simply were not going to allow a black person to testify against a white person in any criminal case. And that was a norm across the country. You know, we talk about the jury of our peers, but for the most part, even to this day, when you're sitting as a defendant in a court as a black person and you look at the jury is not going to look like you. It's a jury of your peers, but it really rarely looks anything like you. And so that was part of what they were challenging, is that the jury was rigged. And so we had no chance of possibly winning the case because it was pretty much set in stone because of who you had on the jury.
What do you think is the legacy of the Red Summer? Because, of course, we don't quite remember it in history perhaps the way we should, but it has impacted, as you've mentioned, it's impacted so much of our culture.
Well, I think that the impact in the black community in particular, this is a time where the Chicago Defender newspaper was a very popular paper. It started as a kind of a hometown paper, but they began to kind of spread news about blacks around the country in a way that hadn't been done before. They were actually outlawed in the South in most states. It was against the law to even be in possession of the Chicago Defender newspaper. You also had groups like the Urban League, which had started earlier, and NAACP. And so you began to see at that particular time a turning point for blacks. Just, you know, not even 20 years before that is a period that most historians refer to as the nadir, so the lowest point ever for blacks, even lower than, you know, the period of hundreds of years of enslavement, was a point where we'd been given these rights after the Civil War ended, you know, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. We had civil rights laws, all these different things. But then you began to see a reversal of those things. And over a 20-year period of time leading up to World War I, blacks went from doing okay to being basically disenfranchised in every way possible. And this was the turning point to change the course of history for blacks, particularly in the South, because the Red Summer was so violent and it occurred in so many different places, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Lane, Arkansas, Ellisville, Mississippi, you know, Connecticut, all over the country these events happened, 27 major race riots around the country. Blacks paid quite a bit of attention to it, and one of the things they paid a lot of attention to was the fight to not just allow people to come in and do these things, but to fight back. And that really built a mindset among blacks that, you know what, it's time that we take the fight to America and challenge it for what it stands for, because it doesn't stand for that for us. And it really, many of the greatest black intellectuals and leaders use that as a springboard to build capacity within the black community to have, you know, organizations that would fight for their rights, to have attorneys that would challenge things. It was really a really important point, and some historians refer to it, like I said, as the beginning of the modern civil rights movement. It didn't really start off as really that's what we wanted to do, but it was one of those things where, you know what, we can either sit back and continue to be victimized in this way, to have roaming mobs of whites kill men, women, and children, and burn and loot and burn property, or we can fight back. And, you know, even though that Red Summer was much publicized around the world in many respects, it didn't end these types of events. Probably the most famous race riot of this type was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just 2 years later in 1921. where hundreds of blacks were killed by mobs of whites. Their homes and businesses and churches were looted and burned to the ground. The largest black-owned hotel in the country was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And literally 35 square blocks of Tulsa, Oklahoma was destroyed, the entire black section of Tulsa, which many people refer to as Black Wall Street because there was a prosperous business district there. So 2 years after the Red Summer, we thought we'd made some progress, but then we had the events in Tulsa. And it just kind of let black people know that we still have a long way to go. We found a way to publicize these things. We found a way to get this part of the national consciousness, but we still have a long, long way to go. And I think ultimately, as you kind of look back on it, I still think that most people, even within the African American community, don't know much about Red Summer, don't know the details of it, don't know how extensive it was. You know, when I was a teacher, I would assist our social studies teachers when they were talking about World War I. And I would tell them that you have to talk about Red Summer as well, because this is something that happened and that World War I played a role in it. And, you know, these were things that were shocking to many of the teachers that I work with. They weren't familiar with it. So I think the legacy would be much more than it is if people remembered it or knew about it or had learned about it. I think that the fact that this is the 100th anniversary of it obviously will, you know, make people more aware of it. But I still think that in general, people don't get it. They don't understand it. And as I've talked about these topics, you know, around the state of Wisconsin, traveling to, you know, very, very white communities and talk about the legacy of some of these things, lynchings and these race riots that I knew they didn't know about, they're quite surprised to hear it. And they're very disturbed by it. They're like, man, I wish I would have known that. I had no idea that those things were done. And I think as you raise people's awareness of it, Joy, what it does is it creates a sense of people saying, you know what, I need to learn more about this. I need to understand more about how this impacted life 100 years ago and why it's still important to this day.
Reggie Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum. He was recently featured on CNN's United Shades of America with W. Kamau Bell. Jackson first spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers earlier this summer. We'll take a quick break and then talk with local musician Mario Quadracci about his new project, Ceiling Spirits. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Mario Quadracci studied at the Berklee School of Music in Boston, and for years, whenever he had the chance, the guitarist was found in his basement studio experimenting. The goal always was to try to replicate what he heard in his head. Well, last month he came up from the basement with his first full-length studio album called Ceiling Spirits. He joined us in the studio then to tell us more about it. Mario, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tell me about this project. It has taken you quite some years to get it together.
Yeah, the end result wasn't really the goal in the beginning. I've always loved music, went to school for music. And so even when I was a reporter at Milwaukee Magazine, I was always on weekends and at nights fiddling about in the basement with my gear and just kind of started to develop this sound and these techniques that enabled me to be able to kind of emulate different instruments and, I guess, create people to play with who weren't there.
So how is it different from a synthesizer?
So I'm using only guitar, and I use unconventional techniques. Like, I use a screwdriver on the guitar strings to create synth-like sounds or string-like sounds. Can kind of emulate cello and violin and viola sounds. I don't have any real aptitude with piano or other instruments, so I was kind of stuck with guitar. But I was always kind of imagining these kind of soundscapes and then trying to coax them out just using the guitar and whatever bits of equipment and technique that I could kind of muster.
So as you were starting to do this, when did it change from I'm just noodling around and playing with stuff to, wow, I think I have something here?
So there'd be some times when I have some friends over late night and they'd ask me to play for them and I'd play for them and they'd be like, why aren't you out there doing this? And so I reluctantly decided to, do just that. And I started booking some shows. And the response was great. And I had a lot of fun doing it. And then I started bringing in this other element where I would start self-producing films and kind of doing this live film scoring thing. And people really responded well to it. And so I put one of the videos on YouTube and got a ton of views, but a ton meaning 10,000 or something. Not
that's
a ton.
Pretty good.
Yeah, because yeah. I didn't promote it or anything. But a record producer, a really well-known record producer, somehow found it and contacted me out of the blue and asked if I'd want to make a record out of the live show.
And so I'm assuming that was like, yes.
Yeah, well, I thought someone was messing with me at first because this was a name I knew. But as we got talking, I realized this really was this person. Yeah, and it planted the seed. I hadn't really thought of it in that way, the project in that way. I always thought of it more as kind of a live thing and kind of thing that was always changing. But yeah, so that planted the bug. But as the conversation kind of progressed with this particular guy, I realized he wasn't going to be the perfect fit to kind of steward the project. But I continued to reach out to other producers and found this guy named Gareth Jones, who had done work with Depeche Mode and Grizzly Bear, Nick Cave, all these big names. And he was very interested in doing it. And we just hit it off immediately. He's just a sweet guy. He really got the project. He really understood kind of where I was coming from. And we decided to take a crack at it.
So in a couple of words or a couple of sentences, describe what the project is now. What did it morph into?
So we wanted to make an album that could stand apart from the live show. So the live show was always kind of married with the film. So we always thought of the film as being, you know, this kind of like necessary component to kind of what this thing was. But we wanted to be able to extract the music from it and still make it interesting apart from having the kind of the visuals to accompany it.
How would you describe the music for yourself?
Oh, man, I have the hardest time. And we agonized over this as we were doing kind of promotion. And when you have to pick genres when you put it on Spotify, and it's really difficult. I kind of just loosely call it post-rock, but that's even kind of a meaningless term. I don't know, it's just kind of a marriage of all my influences. So there is definitely rock in there. There's a certain amount of classical influence. There's some improvisation that kind of comes from my jazz thing.
Yeah, you went to Berkeley, right?
I did,
yeah. And so, I mean, that's what they do.
Yeah, there. Yeah, that's definitely what they do there. Yeah.
I was just trying to think, Gary Burton, does he still teach there?
I think he's still involved. He was the dean for a long time. I'm not sure if he still is. I know he's definitely still involved with the school in some capacity.
Yeah, and I mean, talk about somebody who can improvise.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and all those great guitar players and right. everything, you know, it's a terrific school to kind of get you into thinking about music that way.
Yeah.
And so did you have to think about the music differently once you took the visual out? Did you have to kind of conceptualize it in a different way?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest thing was kind of putting boundaries around things. Because in a live show, I could kind of take it within certain limitations. You know, I obviously wanted to have like the moods change as the film kind of progressed. But I could kind of improvise and be a lot looser. So, but with a record, you have to like bring it down to beats and bars and, you know, kind of put a frame around everything. And I wasn't used to that. So that's where having a producer really helped kind of just solidify and kind of build this frame.
So what do you think the music gains from being in this format rather than the live with the visual format?
That's a good question. You know, one of the things, and my wife and a lot of close friends were always encouraging me, you need to leave, like, make something permanent, kind of like an artifact that will survive. So there's that. I mean, the live show, once it's done, it just dissipates into the ether. Or
unless somebody's taping
it. Yeah, exactly. But the record is kind of like, here's this thing, this statement of artistic statement of where I was at this particular time.
Are there parts of it that you listen to now and you think, wow, I did that?
Well, it goes in both directions. There's a lot of things I listen to. I'm like, oh, man, I wish I could have done that again. But yeah. And I'm generally pleased with the way it turned out.
So now that you've got this, we haven't even talked about getting it with the string players. Mm. Tell me about that experience, about recording in Abbey Road, right? And then you had like an entire string orchestra.
Yeah, so we mastered it at Abbey Road.
Okay.
So we framed the record at Gareth's studio in London at a studio called Strong Room Studios. So I spent a little over a month there 2 years ago in the summer, and we just kind of every day went in and kind of built the I keep using the word frame, but it was like a scaffolding that we kind of like erected. And then we took a couple month break and then reconvened in Ireland, in Donegal, Ireland, where there was a large enough studio to be able to bring in like that many string players. And Gareth had worked at this studio before. Donegal is beautiful, and the studio was really bucolic, gorgeous location out in the middle of nowhere. And so, yeah, then when we got there, we added drums and more guitar overdubs. And then we brought in 21 string players. And we were lucky because there was a classical music festival that was going on just down the road while we were there. It was just dumb luck. And so we were able to kind of hand pick the best players from the two major symphony orchestras that are in Ireland.
And so they just played on your record.
Yeah. It was so surreal sitting there and just, you know, watching them play my compositions. Yeah, it's definitely a life highlight.
And how did they react to the music?
They were so enthusiastic and so into it. I thought, you know, these people are used to playing these incredibly complex, you know, classical music that they're, you know, this is going to be really dumbed down for them. But they really got into it. It was a really fun day.
I bet.
Yeah.
It must have been something. And then to hear those musicians playing your notes, playing your sounds.
Yeah. It was like after that day, I'm like, let's just scrap everything else and just release the string tracks because they sounded so amazing. But yeah, I think Gareth did a good job of blending kind of the rock instrumentation with the classical.
You're having a live event. You're kind of bringing it back to the live this weekend. How are you going to perform all of this? Have you got the strings somewhere in a file that you're going to be able to touch a button and bring them up? Or
we actually are having live strings.
Fabulous.
Yeah. So there's this amazing string quartet that kind of operates in the area called Tontine Ensemble. And so they're going to be playing with me, and then we brought in another violinist, so we have a second violinist. So five string players. They're going to perform their own set as well before the Ceiling Spirits thing. And then we have, I never played live with a drummer before, but I have an amazing drummer and another multi-instrumentalist. So the lineup's definitely expanded.
How does that feel? I'm sure you've been rehearsing.
Yeah. There's a lot of moving parts, so I'm a little nervous. This whole thing is going to be a giant train wreck, especially because we're bringing the film back. So we have to really hit cues.
Oh, so you're not making it easy on yourself.
No.
Yeah, you're actually bringing the visuals back.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so we'll see how it turns out. I mean, I've rehearsed most with the drummer. We've been playing for a while together now, but with the string players, we will only have had 3 rehearsals before the show, so fingers crossed.
Yeah, bows crossed.
Bows crossed.
Bows crossed.
But they're super competent musicians, and, you know, they're reading off the page, and then in certain sections, I'm just letting them go off the leash and improvise. And they're actually a improvisational quartet, so they're amazing at improvisation. And so I've been really, really blown away by, like, just letting them do their thing.
Once you get this under your belt, are you going to take it on tour, or what are you going to do with it?
The plan is to record it, to video it. And so it's kind of a hard concept to explain to people in other markets. So that we'll have the live show, and we can kind of send it around and see if other venues in other markets want to have us there.
Well, here's fingers crossed for that.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping.
Are you still writing, or do you not have time to even think about new music?
I actually have a lot of music that didn't make this project. I think maybe enough for 2 more albums, just already kind of in the can, ready to go. So I'm definitely looking to the future. After kind of we get this live show done, I'm going to start focusing on new material and writing and maybe working on a new record.
So you listened to your wife and your friends?
Yes.
And said, I'm going to do something with this?
Yeah, yeah, and I'm glad I did. I've been really happy doing this, and it's been really fun.
Well, Mario, what a great story.
Oh, thank you so much.
What a great story. It has been such a pleasure having you back in. And maybe at some point we can actually get you in our studio with the quartet.
That would be great. Yeah.
And we can get some live samples.
Sure.
Okay, you name the time. We'll figure it out. Mario Quadracci, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mario Quadracci's first full-length album is called Ceiling Spirits. There's more information about it and him at wuwm.com. We will take one last break and then talk with New York Times bestselling author Mary Alice Monroe, who was back in the Midwest last month. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Mary Alice Monroe is best known for her New York Times best-selling The Beach House series. And while beaches and the ocean can be a relaxing getaway and a magical place to live, the beach can also pose a significant risk, especially during hurricane season. Monroe moved to North Carolina after growing up in the Midwest, and she's experienced many storms living on a barrier island. However, it was Hurricane Irma in 2017 that was the storm that inspired her most recent book, The Summer Guests. The book takes place during peak hurricane season as a storm forces a group of strangers to take refuge at a horse farm in the mountains of North Carolina. Based on Monroe's own experiences working with rescue horses, The Summer Guest not only gives a look into the lives of the people taking shelter, but also into their equestrian world. Mary Alice Monroe joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last month to explain why she chose this topic for her newest novel.
Well, you know, I'm not an equestrian. I don't own a horse, I don't ride horses, but I love horses, and I think that's the point, is that we can love horses and not own them. And it's a universal love. Everyone in America, I think, feels a kinship to this icon in our culture. But it goes a little further than that for me. I was working with rescue horses, and I'm really concerned about what's happening to discarded horses in the United States. So I began working with them to try and rehome them after rehabilitation. And that was up in North Carolina. But I didn't feel the story. I mean, I knew there was a connection to horses, but I didn't have a story. Because for me, I don't know the story until I volunteer with the animals. I think that's unique to my books and my style. I have a species first, and then I work with them. And after I work with the animals, the story comes to me. So I was getting a little nervous. And then Hurricane Irma came, and that was the birth of the book.
Right. With hurricanes, you know, obviously that's not something we in Wisconsin experience directly.
Right.
You know,
tornadoes.
Yeah. So tornadoes, but with hurricanes, we can only see it viscerally through the news. You know, with your hurricane experience, how did that shape this book? Because it kind of follows the arc of an incoming storm passing through, follows various groups of people. So did you live through one yourself? And how did that give you insight of what to highlight? What stuck with you the most about that experience?
Well, I certainly have lived through hurricanes. I actually am from the Chicago area, and I lived in Wisconsin for a long time in Milwaukee and have a lot of family all over Wisconsin. And I didn't know much about hurricanes back then either. But my husband took us to South Carolina, to Charleston, with his work. And we moved to a barrier island. And barrier islands are called that because that's exactly their job, is to protect the mainland from storms. So I moved there 21 years ago. So I've been on the turtle team for Sullivan's Island, Isle of Palms, for 20 years. And I've seen a lot of hurricanes, and I've seen the effects on the beaches. So after 20 years of living on the barrier island, I must have lived through as many hurricanes, because we don't have to evacuate for Category 1 hurricane. So we stay. But sometimes they go, well, oops, that was a Category 2. It got a little stronger than we thought, and my hair is falling out, and I'm shaking, and I'm, yes, I know. So I now know after 20 years to get out, because climate change is a fact now. We all know that. And what's happening to all storms, hurricanes, water events, but like flooding, fires, drought, they're all going to start intensifying. So I wanted to write a book to share with my readers my experience with hurricane evacuation, but also to kind of put a personal note on it, because I do believe evacuation from natural disasters, whether it's a tornado, which already I know have hit the Midwest hard, and flooding or fires, any natural disaster, that we be prepared and get out when the experts tell us to get out.
With evacuation and, of course, the rescue efforts that ultimately and inevitably come along with those, often the animals are an afterthought in most people's minds.
Yeah.
And one thing we don't see or think of is the large animals and livestock that are put at risk
exactly.
in a hurricane. We see the dogs and cats, you know, maybe being transported to different states, but not these massive animals. So how did you learn about what needs to be done when it comes to evacuating massive animals in these situations, such as a hurricane?
Well, it started out with Hurricane Irma in 2017. I now am, frankly, I'm afraid of hurricanes. I'm the first one packing when that storm is approaching. So I told my husband, I'm out of here, and I've learned I don't take my silver and my things. I pack my animals. So I packed up my 3 dogs, 5 canaries, and a goldfish, and there are not a lot of hotels that will take me with animals. So I called up friends. You know, you have to ask who you call when you have an emergency. So I called my friend, and she owns a horse farm in North Carolina. And as I went up, she told me a lot of other people were coming from Florida, because Irma, if everyone remembers, was sort of wobbling between the two coasts. So it was a huge evacuation from Florida with a lot of horses. 250, 300 horses came to try on North Carolina. So that was how I learned so much about the transportation of horses. I got to the farm in North Carolina. This is all a true story. And people from Miami came with their dogs and a big horse. People from Wellington, Florida, which is a big equestrian center, came with their Grand Prix million-dollar horses, you know, for the Olympics. And they came in with their dogs as well. Horse people tend to have dogs. And her daughter came with a newborn baby, and another couple came with their horse. And also these 250 other horses were looking for a place to stay. And they were building the Tryon Equestrian Center, which is in the book, at that time. And Catherine Bellissimo, who wrote the foreword and is now a friend, but she's one of the organization that built this huge Try On Equestrian Center, which had the World Equestrian Games. So she opened up the 500 barns to the evacuating horses, and in they came. There were show horses, there were school horses, and there were rescues all housed there. So those of us who were there, and I work with wild animals, I'm skilled with animals, we all went down to help, to feed them, to brush them, to walk them, to do what we could. So I really heard a lot of stories about the panic of people who have to transport large horses. And I also heard about so many people who were caught off guard, especially last year with Hurricane Michael. They just open up the barns and let the horses run. I mean, it's all they can do. I know in North Carolina there was flooding, and a lot of the chicken farms and pork farms had a lot of loss and flooding. So when you have livestock, not just equestrians, but all people are really scared and caught without knowing what to do.
This book highlights the few fortunate who figured out what to do and were able to all come
they
together.
They knew someone.
Yes, and knew someone.
These were equestrians. And the equestrian world is very unique. And I wanted to give my readers a peek into this world that most of us don't know much about. It's a world of privilege. These are wealthy people for the most part. And this farm that they went to is an actual farm. And that's where I went. And they had multiple little cottages that people could stay at. So we were a group of people up at this farm. And we were fortunate. We had someone we could call. But it was also, you know, it was amazing to be there in a hurricane where you're caught away from the coast, but you're feeling safe, but not safe at the same time. And we all helped each other. We helped the animals. We helped the dogs. But women helped each other. We were cooking the spaghetti and helping with the baby and, you know, walking the dogs. And it's what women do best. And that's when I knew I had a novel. I wanted to write about the people who were caught off guard in this unusual world with horses and dogs. But also they're just people helping people.
Right. And there are many sets of characters that the book follows. But do you consider one in particular to be the main, you know, such as Gerda or anyone else?
Yeah, I think Gerda is the most interesting character. She is actually born from a real-life person that I met when I went to the World Equestrian Games, and I went to para dressage, and I didn't know anything about para dressage. And these are people who have infirmities, and I met Katie Jackson, who is a para dressage rider who had lost her leg to cancer. But instead of feeling sorry for herself, she used it as an opportunity to go for the Olympics. And I just learned so much from her about her courage and her beauty of spirit. And she was my guide to create Gerda and all the details about what you do to care for your prosthesis.
Her example, and you give a little insight into the various careers, jobs of all the people staying in one place.
Yes.
But one big character is, of course, the setting. So what did you think was most important
yes.
to capture about South Carolina?
Well, I think what's interesting about South Carolina is we have both the ocean and the mountains. And that's why in this book, you have the one character, Kara Rutledge, who actually is a heroine in the Beach House series. That's my most popular series. In the movie, The Beach House, was made with Andie MacDowell and on Hallmark Hall of Fame. So people love her. So I used Kara as the person who goes from the north to go rushing home to the island to board up her house. So in this book, I gave you the ocean and what it's like to be on the at a hurricane on the ocean, which is my personal experience, and going up to the mountains where water is a big issue, but also the beauty of the mountains, much more like Wisconsin, where you have lakes and green foliage and hiking. It's a different world than the beach.
Ultimately, this story is also about learning what matters most when it comes to emergency
yes.
harrowing situations such as this. And as you continue writing, what matters most to you when you're creating a story?
You know, that's easy for me to answer. every book that I write, my purpose or the why of the book is really to introduce my readers to a new world, to a new species. Because if I'm passionate and I work with the animals, that's a hallmark of my book, is that I work with every animal, whether it's a dolphin, a monarch butterfly, a whale, or in this case, the horse. I have rolled up my sleeves and worked with this animal for years. And when I look into a horse's eye, I feel a passion. I love this animal. I connect with the animal. And that's what my promise is to the for every book that I write to the reader, is that I won't write a book until I feel it, and you will too. Because my mantra is, if you care, you take care. And that is what I'm really after, is that we all feel connected to this beautiful planet that we share, to the animals on it. Because if we connect to nature, I honestly know that we will have better relationships with those people in our lives that we connect with on a daily basis.
Well, Mary Alice Monroe, author of The Summer Guests, I enjoyed the read. Thank you so much for talking with me about
Thank
it today.
Thank you. It was exciting for me, and I can't wait to get back to the Milwaukee area. I really love Wisconsin.
Mary Alice Monroe is the author of The Summer Guests. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last month. And that wraps up today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of the show here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.